don't know. It's so shallow of me, but I love the Olympics. I love the Olympics when we win. It's my tribe. I can't help it. It's Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM, and it's over. It's a wrap. And USA has won both in the total medal count and also in the gold. Although I haven't seen it, I saw a couple of the minutes of the highlights. But man, sounds like we had a, that's a tight game against Spain. And yes, the closing ceremonies happened last night. I'll get back to that coming up in just a second too. On Coast to Coast AM, tonight's show, it's kind of a twofer. So we're going to break it up into two halves, but both of them so good. If you have ever wondered about some of our unique characteristics as modern human beings, you might have thought, well, gosh, you know, evolution kind of explains it all. It's kind of weird sometimes how we come out like a platypus, but, you know, it's all due to evolution. Well, is it? Our first half of the show tonight, we'll get to coming up in just a few minutes after a quick look at the news and some other headlines. Homo Mysterious, Evolutionary Puzzles of Human Nature. Dr. David Barish will explain some of the gaps, some of the things we still don't understand about why we are, or rather, how we grew to become who we are. Evolution can't explain it yet. Maybe you've got the answer next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So lots to get to tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Let's just start by addressing something that you all have been nice enough to ask about from time to time. No change in the severity or the frequency of my tinnitus, that ringing buzz that I hear 24/7. Which has caused me to cut down on so much of my radio work, at least the work I do wearing headphones, or for that matter, the cervicogenic headaches or the hearing loss or anything like that. So thank you all for your continued concern, and I continue to enjoy staying in touch with you on Twitter. It's just kind of fun to go back and forth and the immediacy of that. If you are inclined, at Deacon Punnett is my Twitter handle. And I was just like tweeting back and forth with a bunch of people building up to tonight's show. Very exciting show tonight. By the way, another brother of the buzz, that is to say, tinnitus, was on TV tonight. Pete Townsend, who's had a bad case of that for a long time, performed with Roger Daltrey and The Who in the closing ceremonies of the Olympic Games. The Spice Girls also staged a show-stopping reunion. Eric Idle of Monty Python sauntered through Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Liam Gallagher of Oasis performed, but not with his brother. Muse performed, Annie Lennox, I believe, some others. The bands of the closing ceremonies of the London Olympic Games will be featured as our bumpers tonight. So we pop. If you missed the closing ceremonies, we'll at least revisit it with a couple of tunes. There have been some mysterious heads in my house these days. I'll get to that coming up in just a second. First, let me just draw attention to a story that's at coasttocoastam.com. There's a story about a woman's missing digits that have grown back in phantom form. This is a really interesting story for me, for a reason I'll get to here in a second, but it's just interesting in and of itself, too. A woman, this is in newscientist.com, a woman born missing a finger and a thumb has grown them back as part of a phantom limb. Okay, so you got to go with me on this because this sounds really crazy, but it's really cool. The woman was born with three fingers on her right hand. At age 18, her hand was amputated after a car accident, and she later began to feel her missing limb was still present. That's called a phantom limb or a phantom hand. Phantom limb syndrome has been something I've been studying a bit about because it parallels a little bit of what I'm going through with this ringing buzz in my ear, the tinnitus. It's kind of the same thing. In my case, dead cells in my ear can't respond to the brain's call. So the brain is sending, you know, like a request for information, a request for data to these dead cells in my ear. And what the brain doesn't hear back from the cells, it adds in the sound of tinnitus, right? So that's the sound of tinnitus. It's just the brain making up a sound to fill in the gap for the nerves that won't respond. But that's the same thing that happens with phantom limb syndrome. That's why people who lose an arm or a leg, they feel some, the brain is sending the signals to all of those nerves. So the brain still has the map for those nerves, and it's still sending out signals, but there's nothing for them to, you know, to respond with. It's a little bit like the missing whales in, what was it, Star Trek IV, right? You know what I mean? Search, you know what I mean? So anyway, so there's nothing to respond. So anyway, so what they do with this woman is, and what they do with people who have phantom limb syndrome, is they put a mirror up so that their brain starts to concentrate. It starts to trick the brain. You put a mirror up and to mirror the other hand that you still have, for example, or a leg. And by spending a certain amount of time every day with the brain seeing in the mirror, oh, look, there are two hands there. The brain stops sending the signal to the other, to the missing hand. The brain gets sort of reassured that there really is a hand there and everything's all right. So that brings us back to what happened with this woman. So she had only had a, you know, she was missing a finger and a thumb before she lost the hand. Now the brain has replaced her in her phantom hand, has now duplicated the hand that she did have in the mirror, and so now she has two hands. So she, the brain thinks that there's two complete hands, even though there's only one hand, and the one that was there only had three digits originally. Does that make any sense? If it doesn't, go take a look at it, coasttocoastam.com. But at least there's a little bit more behind the story. The presence of the deformed hand has now been replaced in the brain's image. That's how she has grown a phantom finger and thumb. It's up there with a couple other cool stories at coasttocoastam.com. And brings me back then to the three mysterious heads that have been in my house lately. First mysterious head was George Norrie's last month. As many of you know who are listening, George Norrie was in the Twin Cities last month, and he did Coast to Coast from the studio that's in my house, the one I'm in right now. We had a really good time tooling around in this convertible I bought at the beginning of the summer. And I ferried George around a little. And we had a good lunch and a good dinner and a good time getting ready for the show that night. Second mysterious, and thanks again, George, and to Trevor and to everybody for their hospitality while I was over at the conclave. It was very nice. The second mysterious head in the house is the zombie head that the DVD of the second season of The Walking Dead comes in. I sent a photo over to coasttocoastam.com. Lex put it up. So if you see this really gruesome looking zombie head with a screwdriver stuck in its eye, that if you lift that up, then in there is the DVD for the second season of The Walking Dead. It's so cool. So it sits on, right now it's sitting on my piano like a bust of Beethoven, like the zombie Beethoven. But inside is the second season of The Walking Dead, which is better than I thought it was going to be after Frank Darabont left the show. Love that guy. And the third mysterious head around my house these days has been that of Homo Mysterious. This is the very clever book by Dr. David Barish, the professor of psychology and biology in Washington, University of Washington. Yes. It would take a man with a great understanding of both psychology and biology to write this book, Homo Mysterious, Evolutionary Puzzles of Human Nature. He's a man who's been focusing on trying to understand the evolutionary factors that explain why we do what we do and who we are, physically even. Evolutionary psychology is what some people call that. Anyway, all aspects of human behavior, male, female differences, What makes us so violent? These are just some of the themes that runs through Homo Mysterious, and it's fascinating. And he joins us as our first guest tonight on Coast to Coast. So thank you, Dr. Barish.
Hi, Ian. My pleasure.
Okay. So there's some stuff about sex I'm going to save to the second hour, but it really is. It's in the front end of the book, but I'm going to put it on the back end of our part together on the show because I find that really fascinating, but I'm not sure. It's in some cases, I can't even get my mind around some of these things that you present, but that's because you've got, you know, we've got major holes, it seems to me, in what evolution can explain, which doesn't mean that evolution isn't true or right, but it doesn't mean, it also means it's not perfect. Are we starting off with the right foot there?
Not quite, almost. Okay. Let me be clear here that there's really no question among, you know, any self-respecting, legitimately trained biologist that evolution really holds the key to essentially all, pretty much at this point, all we need to know about life, including ourselves. I don't think there's any serious doubt about that. Where there is uncertainty is in explaining some of the specifics. That is to say, let me approach it this way. I've been a biologist, an evolutionary biologist, for more than 40 years at the university level doing research and teaching. And to some extent, that means I've been engaging in a deception, not with regard to evolution as such, but just with regard to science. I think it may be worth stepping back and looking at that. Because I think we teach and communicate about science in a way that is somewhat misleading. Because we give our students, and often the public, the impression that science is really a catalog of things that we know. And that often turns people off, because who wants to know sort of boring facts, things we already know? The reality is there's so much more that we don't know. And that the really exciting part about science isn't what we found out, but that which we have yet to find out. And with regard to evolution, I don't think this means that we're going to find out that evolution isn't true or that evolutionary biology doesn't provide the underlying explanation for all these things. It's just that in so many of these cases, we haven't been able to drill down enough yet to understand what is the evolutionary basis for many of these things. I'm not saying the evolutionary basis isn't there. I'm just saying that at this point, we have a number of hypotheses for all of these mysteries, but what we really have, more than anything, is mysteries. And I think what we need to do, and what's really exciting for me and my students, is to talk about what we don't know, instead of just a listing of what we do. And that's why I called the book Homo Mysterious, sort of focusing on those mysteries of human beings, those things that we don't know yet. But again, that's not to say that it's not explicable in terms of evolution. It's just that we haven't explained them yet.
Got that. I thought I'd indicated as much, but I appreciate the greater nuance to that. I don't think of this as a challenge, but I think it's especially for people who have been trying to understand why is it that we do what we do. This is a book that offers, in some cases, some conflicting hypotheses amongst very learned people, or at least the evolution of these hypotheses over the years. Let's start with violence, because there's an interesting blurb on the back. I think, by the way, you have two, you have some wonderful people endorsing the book here. Richard Dawkins said, "A beautifully written book. It has the wisdom of maturity, but with none of its ponderousness, the enthusiasm of youth with none of its brashness." That's a great way to describe it. But then you've got this endorsement from Steven Pinker at Harvard, and he wrote the book about how violence has declined, or why violence has declined. In light of the amount of violence that's kind of been in the news lately, can you talk about that? Is violence something that we are evolving out of?
Well, I guess I have to say again, Ian, like so many of these things, we don't really know. And I'm not sure that Stephen claims in his book that we're evolving out of it so much as there is less of it. But the reasons for there being less of it probably has less to do with evolutionary changes in the human species than it has to do with changes in our environment and in our experiences. So you need to realize that for us to evolve out of something, That means that there has to be a genetic change over time. So what would have to happen would be individuals who are less violent or less inclined toward violence would have to literally have more offspring than individuals who are more inclined to violence. If that were to happen over time, then there would be a shift in the underlying genes of the human species favoring nonviolence. Now, that may be happening. I would be delighted if it were. I'm not sure it is, to be honest. I don't know that there's any evidence for that, and I don't think Stephen presented any. What he presented is really evidence that shows that the actual level of violence as people engage in it is going down. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's been a change in the human genome so much as there's been a change in human culture.
What would you say then is the biggest change in the human genome that we might see evidence of in modern humans, which was not evident before?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I really like that. I'm not sure how we could answer the biggest. Certainly one of the most dramatic, and it's not just one change, but a whole series of changes, would have to do with medicine. And here, ironically, it's a sort of a counterintuitive one. If you look in the past, individuals with genetic predisposition to develop a number of diseases, from cancers to diabetes to high blood pressure, a number of things that would result in reduced lifespan and less reproduction, are now able to survive longer and in many cases being able to reproduce. And so, ironically, one consequence of our advances in medicine has been at the genetic level an actual increase in the underlying genes that predispose us to diseases. So, you know, it's peculiar. Now, it's not a change that I would oppose. I mean, one of my grandparents had diabetes. Well, she developed it when she was very young, but she was able to take insulin and you know, had my father. My father had me. I wouldn't be here, at least not as I am now, if it wasn't for modern medicine. I haven't had any offspring with diabetes, but there may well be a greater tendency for me to project diabetes-related genes than there would have been if insulin hadn't been discovered. And so I think one of the more dramatic changes, and again, it's a counterintuitive one in that it's not something that we would be in itself happy about, is that I suspect that disease-inducing genes are probably more frequent in the human population than they were in the past, simply because we're able to intervene. And that's, it's a troublesome concept. But on the other hand, there's no way to get out of it, because we certainly wouldn't want to let people who have some sort of genetic predisposition to getting sick really get sick and die, because just about all of us have some sort of predisposition like that.
What about the size of our brains?
The size of our brains? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's no doubt that there's been a huge increase in human brain size over time. But that pretty much leveled out in the sort of what we call the Cro-Magnon period, which was maybe 25,000 years ago. And there was a dramatic change in brain size over about a 2 million year period, ending about 25,000 years ago. Since then, there isn't any evidence that our brains are getting any bigger. And again, in order for that to happen, you have to get down and dirty with evolution and realize for a change like that to occur at the genetic level, what would have to happen is that individuals with larger brains would have to have more offspring, be more successful in projecting their genes into the future than individuals with smaller brains. Now, there's very little doubt that happened in the past. Individuals with larger brains almost certainly were able to communicate better with each other. They probably developed language and were able to make use of it more effectively, you know, coordinating with each other, avoiding enemies, you know, doing all sorts of things that helped them. May be able to plan for the future in any number of ways, able to make tools, and any number of things that undoubtedly contributed to their success and caused this explosion, really, in human brain size. But over the last 5,000 years or so, it's not at all clear that smarter people have had more kids.
Well, it wouldn't it be fair? Wouldn't it be fair if all hot women were attracted to guys with large brains? And maybe that's, we see more evolution faster.
There is a theory that
you'll have to hang on for that thought. Hang on for that. We'll get back to that. Homo mysterious evolutionary puzzles of human nature. And I've got a question for Dr. David Barish that was inspired by watching the most recent version of The Planet of the Apes, which popped up on TV the other day. While I was reading his book, I was watching that movie, and a question occurred to me that I jotted down in the margins. We'll get to that next. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So the Who played tonight for the closing ceremonies of the games we won. Do I still sound a little childish when I say that? But it was cool. I don't know if you heard about it. It was, the highest medal count we've had in a non-boycotted year. Something like that? No? Most number of goals? Let's see if I can find. Okay, here, wait. Here we go. The USA finished with 46 gold medals, the most for the country in a non-boycotted games since 1904, when the Olympics were held in St. Louis and many countries did not come. Sorry, George. The USA won 78 gold medals in 1904 and 83 in 1984, but that was the boycotted Olympics. Previous to that was a high of 1945. It was a high of 45, and we beat that. So that's the cool thing. We beat that. 104 total medals, actually 6 fewer than we won in Beijing. However, that's pretty good. We're up there in our some of our best performing years. And so many countries did really well. Countries that had never posted medals before did this time. And all in all, I think everybody had a pretty good time at a violence-free Olympics, which I love, too, that nothing bad ended up happening, despite many predictions to the contrary. Saying hi to Donna and Edward and Dave and Mitch and Virgil and other people who are tweeting at Deacon Punnett. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to keep in touch with you. You were talking about Homo mysterious evolutionary puzzles of human nature. And we'll get back to the beautiful woman, large brain scenario. Also, that question inspired by Planet of the Apes coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So we were talking about the size of the human brain hasn't changed much since the Cro-Magnon days. And Dr. David Barish, professor of psychology and biology, also the author of a very entertaining book called Homo Mysterious, Evolutionary Puzzles of Human Nature. We were talking about how the human brain might get larger if there was more natural selection with men with big brains. And I was just joking about, you know, if only big brains made men more attractive to hot women, that might happen. But I don't necessarily mean that, but it was just a funny joke. But you think there's actually some sort of truth to that?
Well, there's a little bit, and I would actually reverse it as well. I mean, it works in the mirror image. That is,
of course.
If women with big brains were more attractive to men, it would have the same effect.
So there you go. Of course.
Ways, or it would work both ways if it were true.
And yet we don't have any evidence that's happening. Do we?
As a matter of fact, we don't. There's very strong circumstantial evidence that was going on in the past. There's not much evidence that it's happening now. Although, interestingly, one of the evolutionary mysteries that I discuss in the book has to do with art. Now, this may seem like an odd connection, but there's long been a lot of debate among evolutionary biologists, going all the way back to Darwin, actually, but why it is that people, cross-culturally, not just in the United States, people in New Guinea and in Alaska and South Africa, all people engage in some form of music, some form of visual art, some form of dance, some form of storytelling. And all this stuff, if you look at it through the eyes of an evolutionary biologist, in some ways, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't put food on the table. You know, it doesn't keep you warm when you're cold, or
right,
keep you cooler when you're warm, or help you go to sleep, or any of that. So there's a big mystery there. Why do people around the world make art? Well, and there are a number of hypotheses, and I go over them in some detail, lots of interesting ideas, and we don't know which one is correct, by the way, which is, I think, one of the really exciting things. We really don't know yet. Eventually, I think we will. But one of the really intriguing ideas, Ian, is related to what Darwin called sexual selection. And it's basically, the idea here is that the tendency people have to make art and to appreciate it may have to do with a way of showing off literally their excess brain power. And that it may be specifically because art is, ironically now, specifically because the making of art is irrelevant. Because in a practical sense, it's good for nothing. You know, making a pretty picture, being able to dance, being able to compose music or poetry, what the hell good is that? Well, it may be that that's precisely what makes it attractive and interesting to us, because it is, interestingly, of no good.
Right, right.
And what it says then is, hey, you know, the people who are doing this stuff must have really big brains. They must be really smart, because in addition to feeding themselves and protecting them, you know, their children from predators or whatever, they're also able to do this ridiculous stuff that has no obvious benefit. And so, wow, they must be really smart dudes. And so the idea is that in itself may have made them sexually attractive to others. And that may be responsible then for literally the evolution of these various, quote, useless, close quote, behaviors like art. And it may also have been involved in the evolution of our big brains.
Well, since you brought up art,
it's an intriguing one.
Yeah, it is. Well, since you brought up art, and then since we talked about male-female gender differences and evolution in that regard, then I'll go earlier to a question I was going to save for next hour. But I think this is fascinating, and I hope people give us a little leeway on this, because I hadn't realized it was an evolutionary mystery of sorts until you presented it in the book, and that's the growth of the size of the female chest in evolution. Allow you to please lay that out, and then also to try to explain why that's an evolutionary puzzle.
Why is it a mystery? Yeah. And let me be more explicit, if I may. It's not just the female chest. We're not just talking about the thorax. We're really talking about the breast.
Right. Well, I was just being euphemistic, of course.
You can say that word on radio. Right?
I can, but I was just, yes, but I'm not.
I just wanted to make sure I'm not, you know, shocking you or your listeners. I didn't think I was. So, but what's intriguing here, again, we take our own anatomy, our human anatomy, for granted. You know, we don't, and in the course of doing that, we don't realize what a biological peculiarity our species is. You look at other mammals, there is no other mammal in which the females develop pronounced, visible breasts when they're not lactating. I mean, other animals will develop breast tissue when they're lactating, for sure, but that'll recede again. There's no other mammal in which, when a female enters puberty, she develops prominent breasts. Human beings are the only ones who do that. And again, we take that so much for granted that often people don't even realize the mystery that it is. So I think it's worth stopping.
Pondering. Yeah, exactly. But now, what are some of the theories?
I didn't know that was strange.
Yeah.
But it is. It's a real evolutionary puzzle. Why human beings, alone among all mammals, are the only species that develops prominent breasts when not lactating? So then you got to ask, why? Well, as it turns out, there are at least a half a dozen good hypotheses. And which one is the valid one? Assuming that there's just one, it may be some combination, or maybe some other one yet. We don't know. But again, that's where I think the excitement is, that it's a mystery story. You know, we have a lot of clues, we have a lot of suspects, but we don't know what's the culprit. I can give you some examples of some of
the hypotheses. Let's get some of the better ones, or the ones that you think might have a fighting chance in the in the open intellectual competition of your book.
Okay, the most obvious one that most people come up with is, well, the obvious thing is having pronounced breasts is a way of advertising to the male that you, the woman, are capable of producing milk for your babies. You know, you're capable of lactating. So that would seem like the obvious thing. That's why they develop breasts, because it's a way of signaling to the male. Well, there are two big problems with this, though. One is, why isn't that true of other animals? You'd think that a female of any other species would have an advantage if she developed distinct mammary glands, because that would make her more appealing to the males for the same reason. And yet it doesn't work for any other species. So that's one, it's a significant problem. The other problem, which is probably even a greater problem and makes things even more even more fascinating, is that there is no correlation, absolutely none, between pre-lactating or non-lactating female breast tissue and the amount of milk that they produce once they become pregnant and give birth. Because when you're actually lactating, the material that produces milk is glandular tissue. But when it comes to that which maintains breast tissue itself, it's all adipose tissue. It's fat cells. The glandular tissue develops during pregnancy. And that's why women who may be relatively flat-chested when they're not pregnant, as they become pregnant, their breasts develop, and by the time they give birth, they're pretty buxom and they're able to nurse in most cases. Women who have big breasts to start with may also be able to nurse, but actually there's some evidence that they actually nurse less effectively because the adipose tissue they already have gets in the way of the glandular tissue that has to grow. So, I mean, without sounding too technical,
no.
what we're dealing with is the possibility that non-lactating female breasts are actually a deception. Rather than a sort of an honest signal of ability to nourish offspring, it may be exactly the opposite. It may be a misleading, deceptive signal that essentially promises to men that they will be able to adequately nourish their offspring, but which may or may not actually pan out.
So would that be consistent with other species where deception is also a feature to how an animal has developed?
Yeah, there are some cases of deception in animals. But actually, they're more the deceptive behaviors or characteristics of animals are more likely to be associated with their actual behavior rather than with their structure
right.
Such. But yeah, I mean, humans are not unique in being deceptive. But I think, you know, it's a little bit of it sort of takes people aback to think that maybe female breasts, which, you know, most of us think of as attractive, desirable things, may be, in fact, you know, a big lie.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. That's an easy sell, I think, for some people, too. But again, we're talking about Homo Mysterious, Evolutionary Puzzles of Human Nature, Dr. David Barish. All right, so I had this weird question. I was reading your book over the course of the last month or so, and then I also was watching a couple of news stories about escaped chimps, and then I was rewatching the most recent Planet of the Apes movie, the reboot called Rise of the Apes, and I was curious what you thought. We all know that chimpanzees can be very clever. You know, one of these escapes that happened in Las Vegas happened because they figured out a way to get out of their enclosures. They weren't let loose. They let themselves out. And yet watching Rise of the Apes, which is a movie about how in the future, some apes have been genetically modified and their cells have been altered through chemicals, and that their intelligence increased exponentially. So my question to you is, how much smarter would apes have to get in order to be at least start to, you know, if they didn't get the gold medal, at least to be standing on the bronze platform of evolution?
Well, again, that's a fascinating question, and there's no straightforward answer. The reality is depends on how you measure DNA, but we share maybe 98% of our DNA with chimpanzees. Now, it may well be that remaining 2% is absolutely key, you know, in terms of what really makes us distinctively human. But yeah, I think there's a pretty strong argument to be made that there may not be any really qualitative difference, you know, difference in kind in the intelligence of humans and chimps and gorillas and a number of the higher primates and maybe dolphins, et cetera. I don't know that one can say how much smarter is not, it's not a, I don't think that's a question that lends itself to a quantitative answer, you know, with a number. But I think the reality is that a lot of what we've been discovering in animal behavior shows that animals, many, many animals, including birds, for instance, are just a whole lot smarter than we had realized, and that there's an enormous amount of complex intellectual activity that they're capable of engaging in. And this is something that humans are many people at least, are really loath to acknowledge, because they feel that I think it really threatens their own sense of specialness.
Right.
I think a number of people with fundamentalist religious beliefs, it's really a problem, because they like to think of human beings as having been made, created literally in the unique image of God, and hence distinguishable from other critters. We have souls and they don't, that sort of thing. It's also a very troublesome notion, interestingly, for people in the meat and dairy industry, because of the really very inhumane ways so many animals are kept. And if we are to acknowledge the continuity that really exists between humans and other animals, it gets harder and harder to countenance, to accept, to swallow, to deal. I also know to swallow literally when you
right.
eat. The way in which we treat so many animals. So there's a lot of built-in resistance that people have to the note that fundamental notion that humans and animals are continuous, not discreetly, absolutely different. But the reality is, even that's, if there's any single take-home message, and there are many of them from evolution, I think the most profound one is the message of continuity between us and the rest of the living world.
And I really appreciate that message. I was reminded of a previous conversation I'd had with a Harvard professor about apes in particular, and about what he was arguing was that they should be given citizenship and personhood, and that that the IQ level is so close that some cases, obviously, where some of the apes have been, you know, have learned sign language and can have complex conversations through various means. But he kind of, I think they'd said somewhere in the area of, like, if you had to measure them on an IQ scale, there's an overlap already that exists between the lowest IQs in human beings and the highest IQs in apes. And that's why I was trying to understand, like, then how much more would it take, you know, a brain size or brain function for that overlap to get larger?
Yeah, and I think that's I didn't mean to sort of demean your question by saying I can't answer it, but I really can't answer it. And I don't know there is a straightforward answer, but I think it's nonetheless a really profound question. And it may well be that the reason it can't be answered, and part of the reason it's so profound, is that it's not, I just used the word threshold, and maybe that was an error on my part, that rather than a threshold, it's a continuum. You know? And I think...
Right.
I'm not sure who it was you were talking to, but I think there are a number of people who have that perspective, and that's one that I share. And it becomes a real philosophical and ethical challenge, because if we were to measure chimpanzee IQ, and there are a number of ways of doing this, we get numbers that are sometimes 70 to 80,
right,
which is considerably higher than that of many severely retarded human beings. Well, what are we going to do about that?
Yeah. You know,
if we grant the right, you know, various rights, and I wouldn't argue against granting rights to severely retarded humans.
Of course not.
We have to. But if we're going to do that, on what basis then do we deprive these other creatures, given that their cognitive ability is every bit as great? Well, maybe one of them is that we have souls and they don't. And, you know, there are some people who believe that. I don't. I'm not one of those who believes in that idea. But unless you do, I think it gets really hard to draw a hard, fast, bright line between
right.
and other members, other animals.
Yeah, my only problem with your book is that I dog-eared so many pages, I can't remember which page it was that I had my next question in. But
because all of
it is a compliment. It's so interesting. It's like, oh, I didn't know that, and so I was just constantly doing that. But thank you, because that was one of the big ones I had been brought to wondering about, especially because when you get into some of the conversations about how it is that as you talked about earlier, the sort of the male-female dynamics, the vagaries of attraction and other things, it seems like in some cases it just sort of seems just sort of lucky that we turned out the way we did. Would that be unfair to use the word lucky?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think it would be fair, and it's one of the points that Stephen Jay Gould made when looking at evolution. And he and I did not agree on a number of things, or I should say, he and I disagreed on a number of things. We had a number of debates, in fact, about specifically the relevance of evolution to understanding human behavior. But one way, there are a number of places in which we agreed, and one of them was that notion of what Steve called historical contingency. And he said that many of the characteristics of human beings are really the result, certainly a lot, the great majority are the result of natural selection, there's no doubt. But a number of them are also the result of historical accident. And that if you were to replay the tape of human evolution or the evolution of life, in many ways it would presumably come out about the same, increasing levels of complexity and probably evolution of higher intelligence in some creatures. But it's not at all guaranteed that it would come out the way it has.
All right, we'll have to hang right there and come back to that, because I also want to ask you then, and it's a perfect lead-in, to how does or why does, evolutionarily speaking, why does consciousness exist amongst humans? And we'll also give you the numbers so you can join the conversation, too. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett.